Colleges in the United States are different from several decades ago in some significant ways. For one, they tend to cost a lot more than they did before states began cutting public higher education budgets and requiring students to take a bigger share through tuition. For another, the concept of college campuses as bastions of free speech has changed. This is a common complaint from the right wing, that there are no conservative opinions expressed on campus, that it's all a liberal monoculture. Our guest this hour explores the situation from within, within campus, within the left wing. Robert Byers is the author of The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. Robert Byers is a professor of English at Skidmore College in New York, the editor of the quarterly magazine Salmagundi, and the director of the New York State Summer Writers Institute. Robert has published many articles and has written or edited more than 20 books. Robert Byers, thanks for joining us today.
Delighted. Thank you.
So there's a page-long rumination to start the book on being called woke. Did being called woke trouble you?
Well, it didn't trouble me, but when one of my students applied that term to me, I sort of wondered a little bit exactly what she had in mind. She was a student who'd taken several classes with me, and I'm not in the habit of bringing politics into my classrooms, and so I wondered how she had that notion of me. And after a while, as I thought about it, I thought, well, what she probably meant was that I'm willing to talk about controversial ideas in the classroom and to introduce controversial books and somehow manage not to step on a mine as I traverse the territory, and not to offend her and not to offend other people in the room, in spite of the fact that we are willing to open up dangerous questions. And so I had to assume that's what she had in mind.
Would you have used the term dangerous questions 20 years ago, you think?
Yes, I would have.
Okay.
I would. I mean, I've been interested in politics and the intersection between literature and culture and politics all of my professional life, and much of my writing over the years, my critical writing, has dealt with what I would call dangerous ideas and dangerous books. And so, yes, I would have been comfortable using that term before, and I probably used it quite frequently.
So you get to the heart of the matter fairly quickly in the book. Do you find liberals becoming increasingly intolerant?
I do, and it's a strange thing. I don't mean to tar all liberals with the same brush. I'm a liberal myself, and certainly, you know, liberals vary from one group and one circumstance to another. But certainly within the framework of what I call the liberal academy, yes, a great many liberals are increasingly intolerant. And they've established sort of protocols and codes that are intended to punish people who seem to them, at least, to have strayed from the straight and narrow. And that seems to me a change, a significant change. And it really has altered the climate of the campus in a great many places. I mean, I teach at a small liberal arts college, and I have been doing that for 51 years, and I've watched the changes evolve in that place. But I've also taught for 25 years as a graduate professor at the New School for Social Research in Manhattan, which I taught after 25 years, and I travel around the country and speak at many different campuses, and I've heard about these things and seen these things in so many different campuses that I feel comfortable making at least some generalizations about what's developed.
How do you suppose we got to a place where these bastions of many ideas, campuses, now exclude some ideas?
Well, I think what's happened is that, there are several ways to account for it, and I guess no one way you think to account for it is going to be adequate. But, you know, a great many people on campuses are people of conviction, and I would say for the most part people of left-liberal views and convictions, and they like to think of themselves as wanting to contribute to creating a better world. But most of them really don't have the equipment to do that. They're busy with their scholarship and their teaching and their personal lives. They find themselves in this rather comfortable sort of cocoon on a campus. A great many of them have tenure and don't need to worry very much about their future. They have a modest future financially, but nevertheless, it's a secure one. And they feel like they ought to do something. They ought to contribute to making the world as it is into a better place. And again, most of them have little appetite for going out into the real world, the outside world, and working in political organizations and so on. And so they've turned inward. They've decided to make the academy into a safe space, as they call it, and to constantly hunt out deviations, anything that seems to them to stray from the good and the true. And after a while, what's happened over the recent years is that they've created rules and guidelines which are bound to make the academy an unsafe space, in the sense that various people who say things that they're not supposed to say are routinely shamed, hunted down, and if possible, evicted from the space. And that's more and more what I've been observing in recent years. You can see it in the way that human resources departments at one institution or another really call the shots. They call the shots in job searches. They're constantly creating public events in which people are addressed by consciousness-raising gurus who tell them how to think and what not to say and what not to ask. There are online tests which are administered to faculty across the board at many, many institutions all across the country, in which faculty are made to confirm the fact that they know exactly the right answer to give to exactly the most dangerous questions. So that atmosphere seems to me to be an atmosphere that's increasingly illiberal and intolerant. Those are words I use in my book.
So this issue of safe spaces, Dr. Boyers, I mean, obviously we want college campuses to be places that nurture minds and get people to think, but we also want them to think critically. Should they then be safe spaces in that sense?
Well, my sense is that the very notion of a safe space seems to be, to me, misconceived. It's impossible, really, to create an entirely safe space when you're introducing students to ideas, in many cases that they've never confronted before, when you're introducing them to a very wide range of views expressed either in political documents that they study or in works of literature that they read, and impossible to create a safe space when you have an open classroom and you want a wide range of students to raise their hands and pitch in and say things which in some cases other students disagree or disapprove with. So in that sense, it seems to me impossible to create really a fully safe space. Now, if by safe space we mean simply that we won't tolerate certain kinds of insult coming from the mouths of students or faculty members, well, then I think we're all on board. I think we all agree, I really mean all, whatever our political persuasion, we all agree that it's not permissible for someone to call a person of another ethnicity or religion by a disgusting name. It's not permissible to intimidate people by calling them names or calling them out. That's really not allowable. We know that in writing workshops, when a student presents a story for everyone to read and think about and discuss, someone who's just read someone's story can't say, you know, I'm sorry, but I read the story and I think you're stupid. We don't say things like that, and nobody believes that Everyone should be allowed to say anything whatsoever that they feel like saying. We need to create a civil space and a civil discourse, and for the most part, that is what we have on most college and university campuses. But again, the demand for safe space really can turn into something very different if the university suddenly finds itself in the hands of people with a desire to cleanse the common language. I have a chapter in my book built around an odd poster that appeared on the doors of offices all across my college about a year and a half ago. And so every department chair in the college had to agree to have this large poster affixed to the office door. And the title of the poster was "Keep Skidmore Safe." And it was a poster put out by faculty and students in the area of disability studies, a very important area of scholarship in the academy. I have a number of colleagues at my own school who do brilliant work in disability studies. But this poster identifies what it calls varieties of ableist language, which are felt to be oppressive and disturbing, and in that sense, to be eradicated. The examples include ordinary expressions like learn to stand on your own 2 feet, learn to walk in someone else's shoes, expressions of that sort, common expressions that people in all walks of life may sometimes use. And these expressions are felt to be offensive to people who are in one way or another physically challenged. The perfectly legitimate, it seems to me, to talk about ableist language and to talk about how it got to be invested in ordinary speech. No problem about that. But the poster went on to tell students at the college to be sure to gather themselves together and confront professors who used such language and to demand that they cease forevermore to use such language. And if they failed either to promise they would stop or if they, in fact, continued to use that language, the poster gave students instructions on how to file a bias complaint with the Human Resources Office and to bring the professor, the offending professor, up on charges. Now, that seems to me, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about in the book. It's just one of many such things I describe in the book, which seems to me intolerant and illiberal and the kind of thing that creates a really hostile environment on the campus.
Our guest is Robert Boyers on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. So we had a conversation a couple of years ago with somebody who was starting a website where people could call out liberal college professors, and it sounds like you get it from both sides, that you get people who are doing calling out of liberal professors and calling out, in the instance of what you're talking about here, I think, not being liberal enough.
Yeah. I think that's right, and that's the odd thing. I mean, the call-outs in general, what we sometimes call the virtue signaling, is generally directed at liberals, because people who are not of a politically liberal disposition will tend to laugh or scoff at these kinds of admonitions and eruptions. They think they're preposterous, but many liberals in the academy feel that they ought to, in fact, be correct. They oughtn't to do anything that could conceivably offend anyone, not even one person. And they begin to listen to these kinds of admonitions, and they begin to think. And I've heard this from a great many in academic life. You begin to hear that they're going to watch out what they say. They're not going to stray into those territories anymore.
Interesting. So you introduce the term very quietly in the intro in your book, but is this a new fundamentalism?
I think it is. I think it is a new fundamentalism, and you know, and it manifests itself in you know in a thousand different ways. A very prominent writer in the culture right now, a very gifted writer, is named Roxane Gay, and Roxane Gay has on more than one occasion admonished young people and writers of all kinds to, this is her expression, stay in your lane, which means don't you dare to imagine things that you don't have a direct and intimate experience of yourself. If you're a white person, don't you dare to create black characters in your novel. If you're a straight person, don't you dare evoke the experience of gay people in your novel. Stay in your lane. And this sort of thing has caught on in an extraordinary way, and it's penetrated not just to the core of college and university life, but into publishing houses as well. There are many agents, even big-time agents, who won't consider a manuscript delivered by a person who is writing about a group that is not his own. They won't even consider it. Then they would say very frequently to the author, well, I'm sorry, we can't send this out to the publishing house because the publishing house won't even consider a work of this sort. So I would say the effect that this is having is very widespread. It's very, very considerable. I mean, I'm a person who's been running a very powerful writers' institute for many years, and I must say I hate to think that young people who aspire to be writers will feel constrained in the way that Roxane Gay and other people want them to be, that they won't even try to imagine the experiences of persons unlike themselves. This will have a serious effect on the works that are written over the course of the next generation. And of course, it's already having an effect on the kinds of books that teachers feel that they can legitimately teach. Because after all, the prohibition suggests that a teacher who is white perhaps oughtn't to teach a book written by a black author, which is absurd on the face of it, and also counterproductive.
Well, our guest again is Robert Boyers. He's a professor of English at Skidmore College in New York State and the director of the New York State Summer Writers Institute. His latest book is called The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. Obviously within the college campus, he both works on a college campus and considers himself a liberal. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Your thoughts on where we're going with, we haven't used the term yet, but political correctness is what it is called in some quarters. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, some of the concerns are valid, aren't they? I mean, you know, maybe not to, so that white men would never write about anything but other white men, but I mean, can people stand far enough outside of the zones they occupy to fully appreciate the concerns of other people?
Well, I think we have to hope so. And, you know, I hear other writers assure us that for them, many of the great works, the works that they themselves most admire and most learn from, are works, in fact, in which writers have taken on characters and subjects and situations and conflicts that are far removed from their own experience. In the latest issue of the New York Review of Books, the very great contemporary novelist Zadie Smith has a long essay, a brilliant essay on appropriation. And basically, she tells us, well, you know, officially, perhaps, you might suppose that a male writer like Leo Tolstoy couldn't possibly have gotten inside the experience of his character Anna Karenina. But he did. And did in a way that is compelling and important to women like Zadie Smith. She tells us that officially, right, many people will tell us that Flaubert couldn't possibly have understood the life of Emma Bovary in his novel Madame Bovary, but miraculously he did. And of course, I could say, as someone who teaches the novels of Zadie Smith, that she often gets inside the lives of characters very far removed from her own experience and her own family and her own ethnicity. So it seems to me, yeah, I think it's legitimate for us to say that when writers are gifted enough and scrupulous enough, they can manage to cross over and penetrate the experience of lives that are different from their own. And it's a great loss to literature to think that that is somehow not possible.
You know, we get into the issue of diversity here, and you run through the whole issue of campus diversity officers. We talked to one at Southern Oregon University just a few days ago. Does campus diversity, as it tends to involve people like the CDOs, the campus diversity officer, chief diversity officers, have anything to do with diversity of opinion?
Well, I think typically on most college and university campuses, diversity of opinion is not what these administrators and officers have in mind. In fact, I quote at one point, I don't have it in front of me in my book, I quote the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who's a liberal, who basically says, you know, in terms of diversity, we all of us, in certainly in academic life, welcome people who look different from us, as long as they think like us, and I think that's exactly right. And the demand that they think like us is a demand that's pitched not only to middle class white people, but also pitched to black people on campuses who are supposed to think the way black people are supposed to think and have the opinions that black people are supposed to hold. I mean, I have felt this in my own life over many years as a Jew. There is the expectation in some quarters that, of course, a Jew will necessarily hold certain opinions that are correct for Jews, that I will regard the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians in the Middle East in a way that's suitable and appropriate to a Jew, rather than allowing for the possibility that because I'm not just a Jew, that because I'm also a left liberal and an intellectual and so on, I may think about what's going on in the Middle East in a way that has nothing to do with the official Jewish or Israeli line on that subject.
I was waiting for the phrase tyranny of the majority to appear, and it's in this part of the book where we talk about diversity on campus. How do your fellow left liberal academics support the silencing of some viewpoints?
Well, it's funny. There's a great deal of denial involved in this picture. Denial, the kind of thing where you avow something and you mobilize your friends, your colleagues, your students to join with you along those lines to forbid this and forbid that. And then at a certain moment, it may be, someone comes along, it might be Robert Boyers, who comes along at a public forum and says, you know, what you're doing is you're sort of establishing a kind of a censorship regime. You're encouraging people not to say what they think and not to teach what they think they ought to teach. And this kind of censorship doesn't at all seem to be what we're all about in the liberal university. And when you introduce those words, I'm not making this up. Many of these people will say, "Oh, censorship! I'm not in favor of censorship. I'm not talking about censorship." Say you're not. You're not in favor of censorship. You're not in favor of people keeping in their own lane. You're not in favor of telling people they can't use expressions like stand on your own 2 feet. You don't want to punish people who dare to paint a painting. You don't think they ought to be painting. I mean, yeah, sorry, but it's time to stop denying it and call what's going on by its rightful name.
Which is the tyranny of the majority?
I would say so. Well, in some cases, of course, it actually isn't a majority, mm-hmm. because I think in many cases you're dealing with a tyranny that is promoted and made effectual by the most vocal cadres on campus, mm-hmm. Or in another institutional setting, if it's not a campus. So, you know, it may not be that this is the view of the majority, but it may well be that it is the view and the determination of the most activist, the most angry, the most virulent faction on campus.
I mean, should some ideas, Robert, be excluded from campus because they're so injurious or just ridiculous, like, say, let's deport this whole race, that they should be excluded from campus?
Sure. I'm perfectly comfortable with what you just said. I'm not an absolutist when it comes to free speech. I don't believe that that hate speech ought to be a fully protected speech, and particularly on a college campus. So, no, I'm entirely of that view. I would not approve of inviting to campus a person promoting hatred and intolerance and violence, in fact. But again, one has to be very careful in differentiating between that sort of speaker and another sort of speaker or professor, in fact, who simply espouses views that are not entirely popular. That's an important distinction to make. And very often, in the current climate, that's the kind of distinction that people don't want to make. So we've had people disinvited as speakers on various college campuses who are not promoters of hate speech, but are people who make many in the academy feel uncomfortable, and that's, I think, unfortunate. And of course, when that really tends to extend to the kinds of things that professors in the classroom are able to say and the books they're able to teach, well, that's very significant. But yes, it's very easy to attack people who say grotesque and incendiary and violent things. That, I mean, we're all on the same page when it comes to that. I know virtually no one, conservative or liberal, on any of the campuses that I appear at, who feels that we ought to give a free pass to just anyone who wants to say just anything.
Like Milo Yiannopoulos, for example?
Oh, yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you know exactly how to handle an invitation to someone like that. I'm not sure. Which is to say, obviously there are organizations on a given college campus which may have the right to invite someone to speak. And then, in some cases at least, the administration of the institution may have to think about questions of physical safety, the possibility of creating a riot, and so on, and make decisions about what is and is not permissible on that basis as well. And I think that's legitimate. I think people who are in charge of administering an institution do have to think about questions of that sort.
We have an email here from Don, no town given. He simply says, this reminds me of Al Capp's comment on students wildly ignorant or wildly indignant about nearly everything, acronym SWINE. Thanks for that, Don. And let's take a phone call in here as well. We're going to Doran in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey and Robert. I've been in academics now for about 20 years, and I agree with Robert's assessment. I've been brought to human resources. I taught a mass media class once And we talked about the controversy surrounding the name the Washington Redskins, mm-hmm. and I was brought into human resources because I had a student complain about my use of the term Redskin as she was a Native American, and I thought that was ridiculous. I was talking about the actual controversy. And I also know that there's a theory that's called standpoint theory mm-hmm. that basically discusses how you can only view reality from your own standpoint, that you can't think about somebody else's point of view unless you basically walked a mile in their shoes, to forgive that expression. and I think that that's wrong. I think that we have an empathy gene that allows us to look at people from different perspectives and come up with assessments on that. And I don't think that as a teacher I should be admonished for having a point of view that is different than the mainstream point of view or the minority voice.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Doran. Appreciate that.
That was great. That was great. It's a strange moment in which you get what that caller very eloquently described as standpoint theory, at the same time that people are being admonished again and again and again to have and to demonstrate empathy. They would seem to be somewhat at odds, right? I mean, if you're invested in so-called standpoint theory, then you're suggesting that empathy is not only beside the point, but impossible. Nobody can have it. And of course, really, when you begin to insist upon standpoint theory, and you say that people can't even begin to understand or to talk about anything outside their own experience, well, you're pretty much eliminating any possibility of genuine education. I'm not talking about anything exalted or highfalutin when I say education. I mean any kind of education. I mean, what do? When we learn about things, well, we learn about the past, for example. We didn't experience the past. The past is not something that's part of our intimate or immediate experience, but we go to school and we learn about it. We learn about the Civil War. We learn about the Revolutionary War. We didn't experience those events, and by learning about them, we expand our sense of what it means to be human, what it means to be citizens, what it means to be political animals, and in that sense, everything we study, everything we learn, enhances what we are and what we bring to the table. And so the notion that that we should limit ourselves to what's immediate and intimate to us, I would say, is the death of education completely.
Well, you can certainly see where people would be reluctant to put ideas out there, and you say that a number of your writer friends say that this is not a good time for ideas, which makes me wonder, in a climate where careful thinkers are reluctant to say what they are thinking, does that mean that the blurters of half-baked ideas gain some power?
Well, I would think so. I would think so, particularly if people who are genuinely thoughtful are averse to contradicting anyone on the grounds that they will be accused of some terrible violation or crime. I've had people at my own institution on an open email sent to the faculty say, well, I have many things to say on this subject that that the administration has just opened up, but I wouldn't even consider voicing my views on this matter, given the current climate and given what is likely to come my way if I do. Other people say, in social settings, in classrooms, no, I'm afraid we actually can't go there. We can't talk about those things. We can't contradict those ideas here because that will open us up to all kinds of charges. And you know, you see this in all sorts of ways. Some of the time, you know, what's involved is something which is at least potentially and genuinely incendiary, and might seem altogether innocent, and yet suddenly it becomes a big deal. There was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago on the op-ed page by the very good black writer Walter Mosley, who talked about how he got in serious trouble with the authorities on his campus by reading out the N-word in a passage of a book that they were studying in his class. Now, you know, we can disagree about whether it's a good idea to read out the N-word, you know, even in a text, in a class. When I teach Richard Wright or other black writers in my classes, I don't read out that word. I explain to the students in advance that when we come to that word, we're just going to say the N-word. That's what we're going to say. We're not going to, because there are students in the room who will be hurt and offended by the word, and that's not a fight I want to have. I don't need to make those students feel uncomfortable because of that. But I do need to make them feel uncomfortable by introducing them to stories and novels of black writers like Richard Wright or James Baldwin or Zora Neale Hurston, which will introduce them to thoughts and ideas that are perhaps not the thoughts and ideas that they've been hearing in other classes. Then they have to be uncomfortable, and I'm good with that. I want them to be uncomfortable, but I don't have to make them gratuitously uncomfortable by reading out a word that can be handled another way. But again, this kind of problem, we're hearing it even from prominent black writers like Walter Mosley. They're the ones who have trouble reading out that word.
I'm glad you mentioned, yeah, Walter Mosley is himself African-American, so would usually get a pass on using the word in that context, but didn't. Early in the book, Robert, you mentioned Michael Walzer, who finds fault with the left in telling a story that communicates how the left sees the world. Is it because the vision is complicated, or do you think liberals consciously resist getting down to bumper stickers?
Well, I think that's one very serious problem, which is to say, I mean, if you're not willing to, as you nicely put it, to get down to bumper stickers, it's not going to be so easy to communicate your message to a large and various constituency, which is unused to reading carefully demanding books with complex perspectives. But I think what Michael Walzer asks, I think, is that we somehow on the liberal left find a way to fashion a narrative that communicates really what we want. The big problem is, I mean, I say this in one way or another in my book, is that we are of several minds on many of the important questions. Simply expressing our ambivalence, in some cases even our confusion, is likely to draw from some of the people who listen to us a kind of criticism based on the fact that we don't know what we think, we're wishy-washy, we can't make up our minds, so that I have among my closest friends, I have some intellectuals who've written about the black family. For example, the Jamaican sociologist Orlando Patterson is a close friend of mine who often writes for my magazine, Selma Gundy. And Orlando has tried over the years to talk about what afflicts black America by talking about problems in the black family. And he, when he does that, he's admonished for even talking about the structure of the black family, as if to raise that question was to use the familiar expression, to blame the victim. And of course, in Orlando's case, he's not blaming the victim. He's trying to understand how the breakdown in the structure of the black family has affected life in black communities, and how it's affected the education of black children, and so on. So you can see how this kind of narrative about what's going on in the black community can become highly contested terrain when people introduce concerns that a lot of other people regard as forbidden. And I could name many other such circumstances in which you get the same thing.
All right, we'll have to end the conversation here. I just want to take a moment to talk about Carter and Wolf Creek. I'm not going to have a chance to take his call because of time. He recommends Gregory Bateson's essays in a book called Steps to an Ecology of Mind. So that's one offering up in addition to what we have here today. Robert Boyers has been our guest. His book is called The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. He works at Skidmore College in New York State and directs the New York State Summer Writers Institute. Thank you so much for writing the book and for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure.